and it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. Cooking with gas here on a Thursday. Chris Brown here with you, soon to be joined by a broadcast partner who will be on board shortly here. Down the thruway a tad, it'll be one Thad Brown, sports director from WROC-TV in Rock-Cha-Cha. He'll be on board here shortly, and we'll welcome him in at that time. Got a full show for you today, and right out of the chute, we are going to be joined by Andrew Brandt, who you all know is the business of sports analyst for SI.com. He's also the host of the Business of Sports podcast. So we'll be talking to him about a number of NFL topics, including how the Rams seem to make the salary cap seem like a figment of everyone's imagination after handing Cooper Kupp what amounts to a three-year extension for $80 million. He now has 5 years left on his contract to the tune of $110 million. This just a week removed from signing Aaron Donald to a giant extension as well, and no doubt on their part hoping to dissuade him from retiring, which according to Aaron Donald was a very serious consideration after the Rams won the Super Bowl last season. So we'll get into that with him. We'll also ask him about the legal wranglings and handlings of all of the civil suits that have been levied against Deshaun Watson for the Cleveland Browns. That has turned into a quagmire of epic proportions for the Cleveland Browns. So we look forward to talking to Andrew about that and how he anticipates that all unfolding through the rest of the offseason and into the regular season. So we'll discuss that. Plenty to discuss with you around the league in terms of team improvements. And we'll get to our Twitter question in just a second. But with the wild offseason that it has been across the league, not only in terms of quarterback movement, but free agent movement, wide receivers resetting the market price for players at their position, among others, across the league, there are a lot of teams that have gone all in and pushed a lot of their chips to the middle of the table to get better in the span of one offseason. After watching the Bucs do it and win a Super Bowl, and after watching the Rams do it and win the Super Bowl, this is now the soup du jour in terms of the Super Bowl model to win yourself a championship in short order, and a lot of teams lined up to take that very approach. So we're going to be asking you today to give us your one team in the NFL that you feel improved the most this offseason and let us know why. Thad and I are going to be digging a little bit deeper than just one team, as we will be providing you with our top five selections of most improved teams this offseason. And I think it's safe to say that the Buffalo Bills are unquestionably an improved team, but because they've been such a good team already, to put them in the most improved category, I don't think is an accurate thing to do, because there's only so much more they can improve to reach the top of the mountain in light of how the last two seasons have gone. So with that in mind, we're looking for teams that have made up some ground on the upper echelon of the league. And I would obviously put the Bills in the upper echelon of the league. So who from maybe the lower third or even the middle third of the league has really improved themselves to a great degree over the course of this offseason? Of course, you know, we've seen free agent additions not mean a hill of beans when it's time to put everybody on the field and execute. But more often than not, in recent years, with the Bucs and the Rams being the best examples, they have retooled and reshaped their rosters, in some cases with high-priced free agent talent, trades, and they've gone all the way to a Super Bowl title. So let us know, either on the tweet sheet at OneBillsLive or on the phone lines, 803-0551, 888-550-2550, which team in the NFL has improved the most this offseason. So we'll get into all of that whenever you are ready to do so. Not only is Cooper Kupp in the news with his three-year, $80 million extension, I thought this was an interesting approach on Kupp's part, because as we know, Tyreek Hill reset the wide receiver market with a contract that pays him almost $30 million a year. Cooper Kupp, you will notice, his contract, if you add in the 2 years remaining on his deal, his original deal, and then the 3 years, $80 million on top of that, 5 years, $110 million, he's coming out around $22 million a year. And to me, it's not top of the market, and you could argue after being named Offensive Player of the Year and Super Bowl MVP that Cooper Kupp could ask for top of the position billing in terms of a new contract, and he said, I didn't feel that was necessary. So Cooper Kupp, I don't know if he's making the NFL agent world happy by not resetting the market again this offseason at the receiver position, but you can certainly tip your hat to him if you're a Rams fan or you're the Rams organization for not asking for the most possible money at the position in the league. At this time, I believe we have Thad Brown on the line. Thad, thanks for joining us. Glad you can make it. We'll get into one thing that I wanted to ask you about in a second, but what do you think about Kupp's approach saying, I didn't need top-of-the-market money with this latest extension that he just signed? Oh, hold on, Thad. We're having trouble hearing you here. We'll try to work on our audio on our end. I also want to talk to Thad about the Bills media golf outing, which took place yesterday. Unfortunately, I was not able to participate because it took place right at the time that I'd be doing the show, as has been the case. So, you know, we got to work over here, and that's fine. But Thad did get a chance to participate, so I want to hear what he, if he's got any funny stories that took place out on the course, because this year it wasn't only coaches and front office people from the Bills organization mingling with the media in various groups of foursomes. It was also some players who participated. So number one, I'm curious who was in his foursome. Number two, I'm curious if anything wacky happened out on the course. And number three, I'm interested to see how his group fared in the final standings. I know he didn't win the thing, but I'm curious how made out. Oh, I think we're hearing Thad now as he does his microphone check. Okay, so step one, Cooper Kupp not asking for top of the market money. What do you make of that?
You know, it was curious. You know, I think as you pointed out, you know, I think most of these guys feel a responsibility to continue to push the bar higher. I mean, you know, they're part of a team, but they're also part of a union, you know, and in a lot of cases, you know, the union might take precedence because you want to make sure that you're doing right by, you know, not only all the guys that are in the union with you right now, but, you know, there's a players that came before you that helped to push the bar higher to make more money for players. And I think these guys feel a responsibility that, you know, that the guys that were a generation ahead or a decade ahead of me helped make it so that I can make all this money. So I need to, you know, do my part, negotiate as best I can to make sure the guys come after me, have the same situation to where, you know, they're making the most they can make. So that's always a thing that I think, you know, fans don't understand. I think it's definitely a part of negotiations. You know, I think Cooper Kupp is a bit of a unique guy too, in terms of just how he goes about his business and, you know, certainly about the way he developed into a star player. You know, was not highly drafted. It was not highly sought after, you know, really even as he became a better player. You know, he's kind of like, I think, where Hunter Renfro is now, you know, a guy that you're very respected and someone who can certainly be effective. But I don't think anyone would think that Hunter Renfro would be a top two or three receiver in 2 years. Cooper Kupp was that guy 2 years ago, you know. So I think all those things kind of come together to make it a unique situation. And look, you know, I wouldn't underestimate the part of it that he understands the Rams have to pay top dollar to Aaron Donald and Matthew Stafford. And, you know, I haven't seen what his comments are about it, if there are any. But, you know, he may understand that, you know, I need to take 85% of what I might normally get so that we can keep this championship run thing going.
Yeah, I would agree with that totally. We'll get into more of this later, but just because we got to catch up with Andrew Brandt here shortly, but give me your Bills media golf day outing elevator pitch here. Basically, who was in your foursome, how you played, and anything wacky that happened out on the course yesterday.
So I played with Terrence Gray and Curtis Rucavina from the front office. Okay. Great guys. Had an awesome time. Matt Bove from Channel 7 in Buffalo. WKBW was also in the foursome. And we played fine. Not my best day, not my worst. Bove was great. Bove carried us most of the first 13, 14 holes.
Okay.
Had a super time. And I'll tell you what, you know, having all of the players, I mean, not all the players, but having a lot of players out at the event was super fun. I mean, it was great that, you know, Josh Allen, Jordan Phillips, Dawson Knox, Gabriel Davis, Jay Kumerow, Tyler Bass was there, I was told. And, you know, it was just a fun opportunity. You know, these guys that we cover and work with and you know, to a degree are our adversaries with. I mean, I know that our part of the job that the players do is probably their least favorite part. You know, for us to be able to have an afternoon where it was very laid back, have a good time. I know Josh Reed, who works at our sister station, Channel 4 in Buffalo, sister station with myself and Rochester. He played in Josh Allen's group, said that Josh was super fun to play with. So it was an awesome time. And if we have time later, I got a thousand stories we can get into about who won and another thing. But it was just a great idea. Huge kudos to the Bills PR department and Diamond Hawk Golf Club who hosted. But just I can't say enough good things about it. Great experience and a great time for sure.
Cool. All right. We'll get into more of that later for sure. But right now we are going to have to connect with Andrew Brandt, who, as we all know, is a guy that runs the director of he's the director of the Morad Center for Sports Law at Villanova. He's also the host of the Business and Sports podcast, and he's a business and sports analyst for SI.com. And do we have him now, Jay? Is he on the line? Oh, okay. Andrew, welcome in.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, thanks for giving us some time, Andrew, as always. Appreciate it.
You got it.
Plenty to chew on this NFL offseason, as always seems to be the case. I wanted to start with what the Rams have done in the better part of the last week and a half here, Andrew. They continue to convince all of us that the salary cap is just a figment of everyone's imagination. So how do they do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nuance here. As someone who managed the cap for 10 years for the Packers, where some people say the cap's a big deal, some people say the cap is fake, it's not real. What you have to do is understand the mechanics of the cap. The NFL allows something that no other sports league does called signing bonus proration. Now, the reason we even have signing bonuses in the NFL is because we don't have guaranteed contracts. So a big part of your guarantee tends to be your signing bonus for most guys. So what the NFL allows is proration on the bonus. In other words, if you get a $20 million bonus on a five-year deal, it only counts $4 million a year. And what you're able to do is keep the first year number low, and you have big cap numbers later, but people don't seem to worry about later these days, especially the Rams. So I went through this with Pat McAfee and some others yesterday about, take for instance the Matthew Stafford contract, is a $60 million bonus over 5 years. That's $12 million a year in cap. And he's got $1 million salary. So his cash for 2022 is $61 million. His cap for 2022 is $13 million. So you see this extraordinary difference between cash and cap, where the Rams are paying one player $47 million more cash than they're allocating cap. And that's what they've done for Donald and Cooper Kupp and Bobby Wagner and Allen Robinson and all the guys they sign. Having said that, they still have to hit on rookies, even though they're low-round rookies, to balance out these top contracts. And they've been able to do that, too.
Andrew, I think we all understand that what the Rams are doing in large part is because they have a championship window that's open right this second, and they want to maximize that. But there's a secondary part of this in terms of being able to use that signing bonus proration money to essentially kick the can down the road and take salary cap or take dollars that are actually paid and push them onto a future year's salary cap. And I think it's the reason that many fans suspect teams are doing that is because the expectation is that the salary cap in 23, 24, whatever, is just going to grow exponentially. Right now, the number I've seen thrown around for next year is $225 million, which would be a $17 million increase. From what you're hearing, what the scuttlebutt is, how accurate is that, or how much more of a jump could we potentially be looking at next year and maybe the year after?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we've heard about salary cap spikes for how many years now, and we never seem to have one. I mean, we have this 6 to 7, 8% increase in the cap every year. We had the COVID year, but even besides that, it's sort of hovered around $8, $9, $10, $11 million increases. So I think that's really, you know, more the issue. But in terms of kicking the can down the road, it's fine. You can keep doing that as long as you don't make mistakes. And the Rams made a huge mistake. Last year, they counted $21 million for Jared Goff while he's playing for the Detroit Lions. So they've been able to overcome some mistakes in kicking the can down the road. You know, we don't expect Matthew Stafford to be separated from the Rams in the next 5 years, but if he is, that's $12 million a year of dead money. So really it comes down to you can do this, but you better rewrite on the guys you're doing it with.
Yeah. Moving on to the Deshaun Watson situation, which has turned into a gigantic quagmire for the Cleveland Browns. I'm sure you've seen Jenny Vrentis' New York Times report already that now has the number up to about 66 massage therapists over a 17-month period for Deshaun Watson, and also implicates the Texans as an enabler, I guess, for at the very least, an alleged enabler. So how sticky does this make the NFL investigation, Andrew, in terms of them, are they going to want to wrap this up as quickly as possible and hand down a punishment, or are they going to be forced to wait now to see some of this other stuff play out a little bit? I mean, nothing's going to be heard on the civil suits, as I understand it, until after the upcoming regular season. Yeah. So how does this affect the calendar or the timetable for the NFL's investigation and subsequent punishment, if at all, do you think, these new developments?
Well, they interviewed Watson, so that usually indicates that they're coming to a wrap on the investigation. And, of course, they'll look into these latest ones and the latest reporting on the 24th suit. But I don't think they're going to hold this. You know, this has been going on 16 months. It's time to make a decision on this. And I think they will. You know, and listen, the thing that came out in the New York Times, while it's vile, how different is it than what we've been hearing for 15 months? Kind of the same stuff. So I don't know if the NFL needs to react differently seeing another one of these, and whether it was 24 or 66 or 30, you know, this is something that's been out there for a while. So I think we've been waiting for the NFL to act for a long time.
Any idea, Andrew, on what the punishment would be? I know it's probably a tough question to ask, but it's really the one that I think most fans are wondering. Number one, about Deshaun Watson, both, you know, Browns fans and, you know, people who probably want to see him, you know, get some of the worst punishment the NFL can possibly hand out. Is it possible? Is it even likely that maybe he doesn't play it down this season?
I mean, I got to think that way. I mean, I've talked about this a lot where Roethlisberger, 6 games, something happened with one woman. Elliott, 6 games, something happened with one woman. No criminal charges. Ray Rice, an indefinite suspension, like forever. Adrian Peterson, a whole year off the field for putting a stick to his son. I mean, it just seemed, Trevor Bauer, 2 years. It just seems to me that's where we're headed, but I'm not predicting NFL discipline because you never know. It just seems like what is going on here that it's taken so long, and it's clearly a pattern, you know, what he does in these massages. Like I just said, what we heard from the New York Times, really not that different than what we've been hearing for a year.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. And the thing that I realize we're probably splitting hairs, but you look, I'm trying to find ways that the NFL may go more lenient than anybody anticipates, and do they take civil allegations and or lawsuits and treat them any differently than criminal allegations? Because as we know, 2 grand juries chose not to indict Deshaun Watson on any criminal charges, whether we think that's right, wrong, or indifferent. That's what happened. So how do you think that could impact whatever suspension comes down from the league, knowing there aren't any criminal charges of any kind pending at this point in time.
I just said Roethlisberger and Elliott had no criminal charges.
Oh, they didn't. Okay.
So I don't know, you know, if that matters. Obviously, it almost felt like the Watson camp was doing kind of a victory lap when that happened. There were no indictments, but the one thing the reporting in New York Times did talk about was some kind of relationship between Rusty Harden and the Houston prosecutors, which seemed a little bit, I don't know, untoward. But, yeah. You know, I've talked to lawyers where they say that's why you hire a guy like that, because he's got relationships with the system. So I guess it happened.
Andrew, let me move to a little bit different topic here. You know, as someone who worked in a front office, obviously you deal with negotiating contracts. And, you know, we started this show talking about Cooper Kupp's deal kind of relative to what it was in terms of other wide receiver deals in the league. The one I want to kind of get your take on is, and this is kind of a Bills-related question, the Browns recently signed David Njoku, tight end, to a contract that I think was an eye-opener for a lot of people. It seemed like it was a little bit off the map in terms of what they're paying a guy who hasn't been very productive. The Bills are going to have a negotiation very likely with Dawson Knox coming up in the relative near future. When you're in a situation where one contract around the league seems like a rogue number or a much bigger number than expected, how much can one contract impact what you're doing with a player at a similar position or in a similar situation, even though it is just, you know, one unusual deal?
Well, this is what happens in negotiations all the time, where the one side brings up the most favorable aspect on their side. Another side brings up the most favorable aspect on their side, the world of comp. And I dealt with this in my 10 years negotiating contracts, where I try to bring up a comp that was favorable to the team and the agent would have a comp favorable to them. I mean, yeah, it's a comp now. And if this is a negotiation for the Bills, they're going to try to explain that away as an outlier, and they're going to bring up other contracts. And, of course, I would think Knox's agent would rely heavily on it. You know, I think the bigger issue, speaking of the Browns, is the Watson contract. Because, I mean, we've only had one deal since, Derek Carr, and it didn't have the bells and whistles of Watson. If I'm an agent, I don't see how you walk into a team with a top quarterback and not ask for 5 years fully guaranteed, $46 million a year plus. And they're going to say, well, it was unique circumstance and this and that and craziness around him. And I'm going to say, if I'm Lamar Jackson's agent, I'm going to say, are you kidding me? I've had a better career. I've got none of these issues. And that's something the NFL owners are talking about. I mean, this is a massive, massive precedent. The best contract in the history of the league for this guy. So that's really the real issue around the league right now.
As we know, the Broncos, and this is the last one I've got for you, kind of a two-part question, Andrew. The Broncos, you know, looks like it's going to go to the Walton Penner Group for a record $4.65 billion. First part of the question, how much value do you think the acquisition of Russell Wilson added to the sale price of the Broncos? And then number two, how realistic is it, do you believe, that the cost of purchasing NFL clubs may eventually, and I know there's more billionaires than there used to be, may whittle the field down to a point where it's almost too narrow to get competing bids of any kind if the cost of an NFL team keeps doubling in price every 4 years?
Yeah, it's hard to quantify Wilson. I mean, they're more expensive with him than without him. I guess, you know, with LeBron James back in the day, they said the Cavaliers are worth $100 million more with him. I don't know if it's that kind of equivalent, but who knows? Maybe $50, $75 million, who knows? But you're right. Listen, we've got a trend here. The past two sales, Tepper with the Panthers and now Walton with the Broncos, are the two richest owners in the league. So as these prices keep going up, you're dwindling the number of billionaires that are going to play the game. And not that they didn't have a ton of bidders, but the NFL likes people that can write the check. And back in the day, you're writing a check for $400, $500 million. Now you're writing a check for 10 times that. And you're talking about a very limited number of people. And Walton is obviously one of them. And his brother-in-law owns the Rams. The Walmart family owns two of the three richest owners in the NFL.
Andrew, last one from me. I was listening to a podcast the other day, two guys listing their top GMs in the NFL. One guy had Brandon Bean number one. The other one had Brandon Bean 1A. And I don't think it's hard for anyone who follows football even a little bit to understand that Brandon Bean's done a very good job running the Bills. But as someone who's done the job, who understands it from the inside, what has been the one or two things that Bean has done that's impressed you the most?
Well, you start at the quarterback position, and while it looked like a big deal at the time, you get Allen under contract at a number that's reasonable now. Even a year later, it looks like a reasonable deal. And it's not even the number of the deal, but I just thought the length of the deal was a real win for the Bills. It was 7 years plus an existing year, I believe. So an eight-year contract control over Josh Allen is just a massive win. To have a team be able to have that position solidified. And I think they've made selective hits outside the homegrown players that are important, not only for on the field, but off the field. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, right now they're kind of a darling of people picking for the top teams next year, but obviously we've got to see how it turns out.
Andrew, as always, thanks for the time. We appreciate you giving some of it to us. We'll catch up with you down the line. Enjoy your summer.
Thanks, guys.
All right. That's business and sports analyst for SI.com, Andrew Brandt, joining us, also host the Business and Sports podcast, kind of giving us the business lay of the land with the offseason landscape here in the NFL, dealing with dollars and cents like we have never seen before. Billions of them, as a matter of fact. I got to tell you, if you told me in 2014 that the cost of an NFL franchise when the Pegulas bought the Bills was going to double twice in 8 years, I would have told you were nuts. But here we are, man. I mean, we're talking $4.65 billion for an NFL team. And I was reading that there are actually more billionaires in the world today than there were 10 years ago. But you're going to run out of buyers if the price keeps going up like that, Thad.
I guess, I mean, it doesn't seem like anyone's had any problem coming up with the money when it's needed or desired. So, that everything always rises in price. Sports franchises are just, mushrooming for a thousand reasons in terms of their profitability. And I mean, don't underestimate the idea that, in my world in television, that, sports is quickly becoming the only viable live television product. I mean, the only thing that you can say, sit down at time X and come watch us and be successful at it. Everything else has to be on demand. And there is value in that when you can guarantee that I'm going to have eyeballs on something for this 2 or 3 hour period. I mean, it's just one part of the reason, but I don't see any reason why, especially the NFL, but sports in general, is just going to keep getting more expensive, more profitable, and just generating more revenue.
Yeah, and I believe you follow the English Premier League to a certain degree like I do, and we just saw Chelsea get purchased for $5.4 billion. And I had one of my neighbors ask me, why the heck are people shelling out this kind of money for sports teams? And the bottom line is part of what you said, but I think the other part is for big money people like these billionaires – you own a sports team, it is protected from market fluctuations. It's unaffected by recession. I mean, we just came out of a pandemic, and NFL teams rose in value like 17% over the last 2 years during a worldwide pandemic. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, it's what the old adage about the best investment is real estate. I mean, the best investment now is sports teams. You're right. I mean, there's really, nothing safer, especially for the sports that are king. And in America, it's football and probably basketball, even though the baseball revenues are just climbing like crazy as well. But when you're in England, where, soccer is basically the sport and the Premier League is the league, I mean, it's a lock. You almost wonder why anybody would sell, but it's something that's not changing anytime soon. That's for sure.
Yeah. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, Thad and I are going to discuss with you the most improved team in the NFL this offseason. Thad and I put together top fives. We just need you to come up with your most improved NFL club this offseason and tell us why. You can call us at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, or hit us up on the tweet sheet at OneBillsLive. We're back in a second. We'll see you in a couple. Okay, back here on One Bills Live on a Thursday. Chris Brown and Thad Brown with you, and we're talking most improved teams in the NFL this offseason. What we are asking from you is to give us your most improved NFL club in the entire league this offseason based on what they did to improve their roster or their coaching ranks, for that matter, and tell us why. Don't just throw a team out at us. Give us a reason why you feel that's the most improved club in the NFL. You can call us at 803-0550, or you can hit us up on the tweet sheet at One Bills Live. Thad and I went a little deeper into this as we both put together our top five most improved teams in the NFL this offseason, and we're going to kind of go every other here, and we'll start at five and work our way down to the number one most improved team that we had on our respective lists. But who did you have at five, Thad?
For me, the fifth most improved team I had was Miami. And I had the Dolphins just beating out the Jags and the Raiders. And I bring up the Jags to your point about improving the coaching ranks. I mean, Jacksonville, just getting rid of Urban Meyer has got to be worth, what, two or three wins potentially. So I almost had Jacksonville at five. But look, I love what Miami did offensively. Obviously, adding Tyreek Hill, you know, a major game-changing type weapon. And look, Hill's been in the league for a long time. I had to double-check. He's only 28. I mean, this is a guy that's still got two or three really high-level seasons probably left in him. But on top of that, getting Terron Armstead from the Saints to lock up the tackle position, Connor Williams at guard, you know, offensive line's always been an issue for them. They brought in three or four running backs, and I'm not a huge fan of any one particular, but I think between Chase Edmonds and Raheem Mostert and Sony Michel and Miles Gaskin, somebody will be fine. So I think the offense is much, much better and a huge improvement for the Dolphins.
Yeah, you mentioned the team that I put in the five spot. I put the Raiders there. Davante Adams and Chandler Jones alone as the, you know, the headline acquisitions, to me that put them in the conversation immediately. And we all know that Josh McDaniels is familiar with Chandler Jones, having been with the Patriots organization together, and now they're reunited out in Las Vegas. But those two guys alone dynamically change the Raiders as a contender. Now, granted, they're in the AFC West. It may not mean much more than two more wins for them in the division that they're playing in. But I thought the other interesting part about the Raiders was it looked like GM Dave Ziegler and head coach Josh McDaniels took a page out of Brandon Bean's book, signed a lot of tier two free agents to one-year contract. Guys like wide receiver Mac Hollins, cornerback Darius Phillips, outside linebacker Kyler Fackrell, wide receiver Demarcus Robinson, linebacker Jayon Brown from Tennessee. I mean, these aren't household name players, but on one-year contracts, they're going to be motivated to earn their next contract and play hard for this team. So it's interesting the approach that they're taking, not all that dissimilar to what the Bills did early on in their build into what they are now.
The one thing about the Raiders that kept it out for me was Adams is going to turn 30 in December and Chandler Jones is 33. You know, those two guys had super years last year and should probably, you know, be as close, if not just as good as this year. But they are both at that age. I mean, for a receiver now, 30 years old is about the time a receiver starts to drop off production-wise. So to me, your top two on guys who I love as much as you do, their age to me is a little more of a risk that you don't get what you're paying for out of those players compared to Miami. But I agree with you. The Raiders had a great offseason. I also agree, by the way, that great offseason might not be worth anything when it comes to wins and losses just because of who else is in the division. And to that point, my number four team was the Chargers. And similar to what the Raiders did, they added impact players at impact positions. Khalil Mack, J.C. Jackson, probably the two best available players in terms of corner and pass rusher in this past offseason. You could argue a couple other guys, but now you're going to have A Bosa on one side and Khalil Mack on the other. When you face the Chargers, that's going to be a nightmare for opposing offenses. J.C. Jackson helps solidify a secondary that's been very – I mean, that defense has been not good, you know, for a long time. Obviously, Justin Herbert and that offense has already been pretty good. And, you know, they added another lineman in Zion Johnson, a guy in the draft who I love. So I think that the Chargers did a great job filling major holes with major pieces. But again, you know, and when I was going through this list, I'm thinking, well, improved has got to mean more wins, right? But it's hard to, you know, to think that all these teams that are better are going to win a whole lot more games. Also, you know, if I'm thinking improved only means more wins, then the whole list would be the Texans, Jags, Jets, and all these terrible teams last year. So right. I think for teams who got better that were middle to upper level already, I think the Chargers did one of the better jobs in the offseason.
Okay, so number four for me, I had the Dolphins. I don't need to reiterate a lot of what you said. I know you mentioned Chase Edmonds and Raheem Mostert. They also added Sony Michel here recently, so they got another guy. And you know, if he's bringing that Shanahan offense with him, Mike McDaniel's going to use all of those guys in some way, shape, or form. And it's going to be very interesting for me to see how much more of a play-action quarterback McDaniel makes Tua with all the run concepts that you know are going to be part of that offense. And then the other thing about the Dolphins was Melvin Ingram was a nice shot in the arm for the Chiefs last year. Can he be that and be an effective guy playing off of Jalen Phillips, who I think was just starting to realize how dominant he could be in a football game late in the season last year? That could be a combo that actually has more production than I think people are anticipating. All right, number three for you, Thad.
Number three for me was the Jets. This is kind of an easy one. Now, look, the Jets, frankly, could have added anybody and it would have improved them. I mean, they were, you know, pretty much that bad last year. But I really like what they did in terms of improving the secondary, which was the biggest train wreck of that giant train wreck. You get DJ Reed and Jordan Whitehead, two solid, not high, not number one type guys, but very dependable, you know, high level players, one at safety, one at corner. You grab Laken Tomlinson, the guard, also really, really good from the Niners, paid him a ton, you know, for a guard, but shores up the offensive line. And then, of course, in the draft, the Jets had a ton of assets, but they come out of the draft with what some people say is the best corner. I agree, in Sauce Gardner. What some people say is the best running back. I agree, in Breece Hall. What some people say is the best wide receiver. I vehemently disagree, in Garrett Wilson. They might even got the best tight end in the draft, too. That's good offseason work. And I think, you know, obviously the Jets are going to go as far as Zach Wilson's going to take them, but they've done a really good job of improving around them. And I didn't even throw in the fact that they're essentially going to add two edge rushers this year, Jermaine Johnson, who they drafted, but Carl Lawson, who they signed in the offseason last year, didn't play it down because he blew his Achilles in training camp. You get him back. So this roster is going to be a whole lot better next year.
Yeah, the Jets just missed the cut for me. I had him at like number six. For most improved teams. And the only reason why was because while all this draft pick talent is good, it's still unproven. And I realize that some of these guys are probably going to have some success right away. Running backs typically do, so that spells good things for Breece Hall. But I was looking more at teams that added proven talents at this level and kind of ranked them a little bit higher. So for number three for me, and I realized they were a fringe playoff team last year, but I went with the Eagles here. And again, the headline acquisition is the draft day trade for A.J. Brown, giving them a true number one wide receiver for Jalen Hurts. Also added pass rusher Hassan Reddick. Are we sensing a pattern here? Wide receivers and pass rushers. James Bradbury added on the back end recently after he was cast off by the Giants, gives him a top two corner. And then in the draft, they got Jordan Davis and Nakobe Dean from Georgia's national title winning defense. So I think the Eagles could be right there with the Cowboys pushing them in the NFC East. All right,
number two for me was the Eagles. So I'm right with you. I really love their offseason. And, you know, you were kind of alluding to it a minute ago. The teams that we, I think, both largely have towards the top, they're not just adding good players. They're adding them at impact positions. You know, I like the Jets draft because – yeah, they got great players, but they didn't get great linebackers and safeties. They got great receivers and corners and pass rushers. Same thing here with the Eagles. You know, they added at receiver. They added at pass rusher. I know Jordan Davis is defensive tackle, but he's a guy that is seen as someone that can really be a quarterback problem in the, you know, pass defense game. And then Nakobe Dean, you know, picking him up where they grabbed him. I mean, he was a guy that a lot of people thought would go in the first round. They grabbed, I think, round three. So the Eagles had a really nice offseason. And, you know, they're a little further along in their quarterback progression than I think most rebuilding teams are. Jalen Hurts is already, you know, he's been to the playoffs already once. And I don't know if he'll ever be a great quarterback, but I feel a lot better about him than I do about the three guys in the AFC East, Trevor Lawrence, all those guys. So I think the Eagles did a really good job around him.
Yeah. Number two for me, I went Broncos. I felt the only thing that team was missing to compete in the AFC West was a quarterback. And for my money, they probably landed the best quarterback this offseason of the ones that were available in Russell Wilson. And he's got a reliable run game with Javonte Williams, plenty of weapons, Cortland Sutton, Jerry Jeudy, Tim Patrick. They also drafted Greg Dulcich out of UCLA, who I think is an underrated pass-catching tight end. And their secondary, solid. My only concern is their linebacking unit, which is solid, but not great. Before we get to our number ones, though, Thad, let's go to the phones at 803-0550. And leading us off today is Mark in West Seneca, who has his most improved team. Who do you have, Mark? You're on One Bills Live.
Well, I think you guys touched on it already. I was very impressed with what the Chargers did.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, they got a great quarterback, and their offense is pretty imposing. But what they did on defense, bringing in the cornerback and a couple defensive linemen, I think they really, really improved their defense big time. And if those guys play up to par, they could be pretty imposing down the road, especially getting into the playoffs and that.
Yeah, I mean.
So, and then I wanted to make a comment, if sure. You guys give me a little bit of leeway, about the Deshaun Watson situation.
Mm-hmm.
The Browns are being roundly criticized for what they did, their ownership, which they 100% deserve. But what really has surprised me is the lack of criticism the league is getting for hanging back in the weeds. And I know they hide behind things like ongoing investigations, this, that, and the other.
Oh, geez. Looks like your cell dropped out there. Sorry, Mark. I don't know what
happened. I think he made his point, though. Yeah, I mean, the one thing about the NFL thing that I want to say is that the NFL doesn't really have to act yet. You know, they have the opportunity to kind of sit back and wait until, I mean, they really don't have to do anything until preseason at earliest. And probably if Deshaun Watson's on the field week one, then there's a problem. But until then, you know, I think it might even behoove the NFL to take its time and try and get this right.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, I think the majority of times when the NFL has punished a player for conduct unbecoming or other reasons, the league has been roundly criticized. And look, there's a thousand reasons we get into for why that is, but in terms of a timeline, you know, I think the NFL probably is better off sitting in the weeds. It's June, you know, we don't have 3 months. Get it right and don't be hasty about it just because someone wants you to do it right this second. Not to, you know, hammer Mark, but the point I'm making is that I think the NFL's in a decent spot to take its time in this situation.
Right. And in the times where they have rushed to judgment, they've had to retrace their steps, and the Ray Rice incident comes to mind, maybe bigger than any of the others. You know, they made an initial ruling, and then the video comes out, and it's just like, oh, geez, we got to do more than what we just did here. And so they're, you know, now they got to go back, tail between their legs, and say, we made a rush to judgment, more severe punishments necessary. And so I think that's why they would prefer to wait, because who knows? Details like the New York Times article by Jenny Vrentis comes out, and there's a whole new layer to the thing, which demonstrates with 66 women over 17 months that guilty or not guilty, there was a definite agenda on Deshaun Watson's part that ran completely in the opposite direction from taking care of his body, so to speak, with massage therapy. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, Thad and I will give you our number one most improved teams this offseason. We're happy to take yours as well at 803-0550. We're back in a second here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, which NFL club is your number one most improved team this offseason? We all know that the proof is going to be in the pudding when they all step on the field, but who looks the best on paper right now in terms of making their team significantly better than it was last year? Thad and I are counting down our top five, and we are at number one for each of our respective lists. So quickly to recap, Thad, give us your 5, 4, 3, and 2, and then give us your 1.
Dolphins at 5, Chargers at 4, Jets at 3, Eagles at 2, and my number 1 is the Broncos. Your number 2, for largely the same reason. Look, we talk about adding players at impact positions. A lot of these other teams have done that. There's no more impact position than quarterback. And I don't know if Russell Wilson is any more of or is still among the top maybe 3 or 4 or 5 quarterbacks, but he's still darn good. And he's still way better than Drew Lock. And for a team that, you know, seemed like they might be just that guy away, adding that guy is huge. Don't overlook the fact they also nabbed Randy Gregory from Dallas. I like him a lot as an edge rusher. You know, the Broncos already have a pretty good pass rush there, so you add him to it. I think those two guys by themselves are pretty big steps for Denver moving forward.
Yeah, number one for me was a team you already had. It's the Chargers. Again, as we said, premium positions addressed in a big way. The trade for Khalil Mack, who's going to be teamed up with Bosa now. That's a hell of a duo. J.C. Jackson, the corner, as you mentioned. Now you line him up, and they have Mike Davis on the other side. They've got Asante Samuel as a true nickel now. He can play there full-time with J.C. Jackson in the fold. And I think what they did on the defensive interior is very underrated. Sebastian Joseph Day, Austin Johnson, two solid interior defenders. And then they strengthen their O-line with their top pick in the draft in Zion Johnson, who's probably a plug-and-play guard as a rookie. They even got a backup for Austin Ekeler and Isaiah Spiller in the fourth round, the running back out of A&M. So their defense is going to be dramatically improved, which was their main sticking point last year and ultimately kept them out of the playoffs. And let's not forget, there were only two guys that passed for 5,000 yards last year, and one of them was Justin Herbert. The other was Tom Brady.
Brownie, look, I get hooked to the Chargers train every year. It's going to happen to me again this year, too. I'm trying not to get overly excited about them. This will be at least the third year in a row where I'm like, oh, look out for the Chargers. Chargers going to be great this year. And then they go in Charger during the season and don't find a way into the playoffs or to, you know, reach that potential. So I'm trying to back off, but I'm totally with you on the Chargers. You know, if they won that division, as great as that division is, it wouldn't stun me at all.
Yeah, their problem's been injuries. They can't stay healthy. Mm-hmm. They've got 6, 7, 8 key players injured by like week 4. And then the wheels fall off and they can't win games. And if that happens think about it. What do we each had, what, 3 AFC West teams in our top 5? I mean, if one
you,
of these teams...
You had 3, I had the Raiders at like 6. So yeah,
oh, that you had the Raiders at 6, yeah. Right. I mean, if one of these teams has injuries like the Chargers have had the last few years, forget it. They're going to be like 6-11.
And I'll tell you what, I really wasn't going to put them in, but I toyed with talking about the Chiefs in this segment only because, look, you lose Tyreek Hill, and they've lost other guys too, but at that wide receiver group, Tyreek Hill is such a great individual player, but they've gone from him to MBS to Sky Moore, who I love, the rookie, and Juju Smith-Schuster. They might be a whole lot deeper at receiver than they've ever been when it was Tyreek Hill and whoever. I think that whole division has done good things in the offseason in a lot of ways. The Chiefs aren't going to make this list, but you know, don't underestimate them as a team that might be in a better position than we'd think losing Tyreek Hill.
Yeah, so that's our list. You guys let us know what you think. We've got hour number 2 coming up with your phone calls and your tweets as we check in on the tweet sheet to see who you guys feel is the most improved NFL club this offseason. And please tell us why as well. Don't just list a team and say out. Give us a reason why you think that. Quick little note here, Thad, that I saw regarding the XFL. I don't know if you saw this, but they named some coaching additions to their respective teams. They include 2 former Bills head coaches. Did you see the list?
No.
Okay, so
can I guess?
Yeah, that's why I'm glad you didn't see it. Nice. So if you had to guess, who are the 2 coaches that you think are going to be either A head coach or B an assistant coach? Because it's 1 and 1.
Doug Marrone?
No.
Okay. So is it 1 former Bills assistant, 1 former head
coach? No, it's 2 former Bills head coaches, but one is going to be a head coach in the XFL. The other is going to be a coordinator.
Well, Greg Williams would be perfect for the XFL. Got to be him, right?
He is going to be a defensive coordinator, correct?
Nice. Okay, so the other one, we're not counting Perry Fuel. Would that be a guess?
We are not counting Perry Fuel, no.
Okay. It's not Dick Duran, is it?
Oh, God, no. It is not Dick Duran.
I was going to say. Who am I missing? Let me think.
I will give you
Rex
a hint.
Ryan. Rex Ryan.
It is not Rex Ryan. It is a guy who recently took a picture with a dude that is fronting a lot of the money for the XFL and is the face of the XFL. He actually took a picture with him. I think it was on Twitter. He took a picture with The Rock.
I should know the name.
You didn't see the post. Because if you saw the post, you'd know right away.
Yeah.
I thought I was helping you, and I probably didn't.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I know. I can see the face. I'm missing the name. It's the post-Greg Williams, pre-Dick Geron coach. He was offensive guy in Buffalo for 2 years. I should know the
it's
name.
Not Mike the right guy, right? It's not Mike Mularkey. It's not Mike
Mularkey. No, okay. Then I'm out.
It's actually Wade Phillips.
Oh, all right.
It's Wade Phillips on the wrong side of 70. He's going to be the head coach of one of these XFL teams. So the league is assembling these coaching staffs, and they're going to assign them to teams later. This is insane. I've never seen that, but that's what they're doing.
That's how they're building it. I think the new USFL kind of built it that way, too.
I mean,
the USFL plays their entire league down in Birmingham.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not about forming franchises and coming together. It's about we're going to build a league, and then we're going to kind of farm everything out to everywhere we want
it
to go.
Yeah, I guess it saves money that way. That's the only thing I can think of.
Right.
But there it is. Greg Williams will be a defensive coordinator for a team in the XFL next year, and Wade Phillips will be a head coach next year in the XFL. I think he's going to be 71 next year. So they can't give it up, man. They can't give it up. We got to keep on trucking.
Hey, God bless Wade Phillips, who still wants to be a head coach.
I'm telling you, man. That's going to be frustrating. I don't know. Just running a startup team at age 71, that's a heavy lift. I don't know if I'd be signing up for that. I'd be counting my dollars and drinking my Diet Dr. Peppers on a lounge chair somewhere in West Texas. We have to take a break here. When we come back, your thoughts on who you feel is the most improved NFL club this offseason with your phone calls and your tweets next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual-role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right, hour number two. Chris Brown, Thad Brown with you. Sports director, WROC-TV in Rochester. Helping me out here while Steve is out for the week. And we're talking about most improved teams in the NFL. Thad and I gave you our top five. All we need from you is which single team in the NFL do you believe has improved the most this offseason, and let us know why. 803-0550, the number to call to let us know, or 1-888-550-2550, toll free. And we'll get to your calls as we have open lines for you here shortly. But let's go to the tweet sheet here first. And I had Chargers number one. Thad had Broncos number one. Be interesting to see what you have. So tweet sheet, as always, brought to you by Corrigan Moving Systems, the official equipment moving company of the Buffalo Bills. Randall leads us off, and he says, the Jets, not for immediate success, but for the future. All those high draft picks will help the team in years to come. Otherwise, it's Denver. Adding Wilson to that offense is huge. Judy coming back. Sutton will have a better year along with a good defense. Question for you on the Broncos, though, Thad. Is the defense going to be just as good with Vic Fangio no longer the head coach? I mean, he's known as the defensive guru. How much does that defense slip, if at all, with no Fangio anymore?
I think it'll be a hit. You know, I think Fangio did a good job, I think, solidifying that defense. You know, who is the defensive coordinator there now? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not.
You know, off top of head, Brownie?
I'm not going to pretend to know either. No.
Yeah. Like I said, they grabbed Randy Gregory as a pass rusher. The other side is the recent
Chubb,
draft
pick Bradley Chubb.
Thank you. So I mean, they have guys, you know, still at you know, important positions there. I don't think losing that coach is going to make that big a difference. But look, Fangio has been Ed Donatell's the defensive coordinator.
Oof.
So no opinion. So I think it'll be an impact, but not that big of an impact in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of Donatell. I always get
Matt at best, I would say.
Yeah, I always get a little bit concerned when head coaches bring in coordinators who have just been around because they've been around. I mean, Donatell has not really excelled as a coordinator, I want to say, since the late 90s. I mean, it's been a while. And I'm not trying to be ageist with this comment here, but he hasn't excelled in his role in a while. That's not to say, you know, coaches in their 60s can't do it. Look at Leslie Frazier. He's leading the league in defense. He's had a top three unit like three of the last 5 years. But Donatell hasn't done a whole lot in a long time. And so I'm a little wary now that I've been made aware this guy's their defensive coordinator. Now I'm even more concerned.
The one thing I'll say about coordinators, and I've done research on this a little more on the offensive side than the defensive side, but generally good coordinators are guys that have good players. Like, I don't know if there really is coordinator out there that makes a head coaches. Yes. But, you know, there's only been a few, you know. I think Wade Phillips defensively is one of those guys. So look at Brian Daboll. He was a coordinator of three different styles before he came to Buffalo. Didn't do anything because he never had a quarterback anywhere near what Josh Allen is.
Yeah.
So I think in large part, when it comes to coordinators, if the players are good, then the coordinator probably will look good.
Yeah, that's fair. I'll buy that for a dollar. I don't have a problem with that. Number two on the tweet sheet, Dapper D says, just trading for Russell Wilson alone unquestionably makes Denver the most improved team. Their quarterback situation went from near the bottom of the league to top 10 instantly. And, you know, in what is a quarterback league, Thad, like I said, you get a guy like Wilson, who's probably the best of the lot in terms of the guys that were available. Yeah, I mean, it shoots you up the board in terms of relevance and being a threat to the other teams in the AFC. I'm just wondering, though, how many wins is it going to take to win that division? Is 11 going to be good enough just because you're going to be all beaten up on each other? I'm wondering, like, 11-6, does that win the AFC West?
I think it does, but I think you've got to curve the records. So 11-6 in the AFC West is probably 13-4 everywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the way you got to look at it. You know, so getting to that number of wins is not going to be any sort of easy task. The one other thing I want to say about the Broncos, going back to the last tweet, the guy was talking about Jerry Jeudy coming back and Cortland Sutton. This team has had that group of young receivers for a couple of years now. Jeudy is good and got all this potential. Cortland Sutton, we've seen it from time to time. I don't know if they have a legit number one receiver on that team. You know, they've got guys who we think could be that or have shown signs of that, but neither one, especially Sutton, have not been consistently week after week, you know, that kind of Stephon Diggs, you know, I'm going to take on your number one corner. I'm going to be the guy you depend on all the time. And to me, that makes a difference. Russell Wilson's always had that in Seattle to some degree.
Well, right. But to your quarterback point, with coordinators, I think the same applies to receivers. And Sutton did have a big year. And then the next year he came in, high expectations, blows out his knee in like week two or three, and he's out for the year. He comes back last year. He still doesn't look right. And he's got, you know, a lousy quarterback throwing to him. We'll know this year exactly what they have at the receiver position. I think Tim Patrick is an underrated number three. And then KJ Hamler, granted, he's coming back from an ACL, but that's not a bad number four. I mean, my God, you could do a lot worse than KJ Hamler as your number four receiver. So Russell Wilson.
They're incredibly deep. I just don't know if they have that elite guy at the top, but your quarterback point is excellent.
Yeah. Jack on the tweet sheet says, I'd say Denver. Are we going all the way through here? Oh, no, we're not. Okay. I'd say Denver. They added a stud at QB. Who knows what it takes to win? Blah, 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 blah. It's a QB-driven league. Denver added a beast there, and thus they're the most improved. Okay, fair enough. I think we've belabored that point. Steve on the tweet sheet says, every team in the AFC West other than the Chiefs. Wow, what a juggernaut of a division. Having to play the AFC West this year is a gauntlet for any opposing team. Well, fortunately, the Bills don't play the AFC West. Neither do any of the other teams in the AFC East. They just have to play the Chiefs in the cross intra-division finish in your division game. Do you know off the top of your head, Thad, which division in the AFC has to play the AFC West. It's not the North.
Yeah, it's South and West. Since the Bills are going to play all the North teams, and the South and the West have to play each other. So the one thing, you know, we talk about how the West is going to just beat each other up all year long. And it's going to be tough. Well, they all get to have breathers against the Jags and
the Texans,
against Houston. And they probably play the weakest pair of division contenders in Indianapolis and Tennessee of anybody in that conference. Now, I think the second place team in the South is probably better than the second place team in the AFC East, but the Bills are better than both those teams. So, you know, from that point of view, there are some extra wins that will be afforded the AFC West because you get to play the South this year.
Yeah. Pat on the tweet sheet says, I'd have to say the Jets had an A-plus draft this spring, and the Chargers did well also. With three first-round picks of plug-in and play guys is huge. We'll get to see how well they did. It will only make us better. I think you and I, though, are still in agreement that they're unproven. I mean, a lot of these – I mean, look, they had a great draft. The Jets had a great draft. Joe Douglas did fantastic, and even some of the free agent acquisitions that you pointed out are worth noting too. Carl Lawson, I think, is a question mark because some guys, especially at those high impact burst type positions like pass rusher, corner, sometimes they just don't look the same after an Achilles injury. I know the technology has gotten better in repairing those, but Carl Lawson's a question mark. So the fact that they drafted Jermaine Johnson was big when they traded back up into the bottom of round one. Basically, this draft isn't a success unless this Jets coaching staff can prove that they excel in an area where the Bills coaching staff excels in, and that's player development.
Yeah, and it goes with every team, every draft. I mean, that's, you know, that's a common theme. I think what the reason you look at the Jets and are encouraged or optimistic about their draft is, you know, like I said a couple segments ago, the guys they landed were arguably the best in their position at the draft. I mean, they might have gotten every single offensive skill spot the best player in the draft. So, you know, the building blocks are there. But you're right. I mean, look, I'm no Garrett Wilson fan. You know, I know some people thought he was the best receiver in the draft. People, I think, look at him as a Stephon Diggs type, you know, just a really quick, sudden route runner, good after the catch. But I don't see anything in this guy's college film that makes me think he's elite or dominating in any one area. I think he's going to be a solid NFL player, but not a star, you know. And then on this Ohio State team, I thought Chris Olave was a better receiver this year, and the guy they got coming out next year is pretty much universally looked at as the best of the three. And then beyond that, Jermaine Johnson, there's a reason he fell all the way down to 26. First of all, he's an older guy just in terms of literal age, and number two, he's not fast. You know, people love Kayvon Thibodeau because he was Von Miller quick getting to the quarterback. Jermaine Johnson is a hand technician. He's really good at it. But the other part of it is there's not a whole lot. It looks like you can teach him in the NFL. Most guys who come in as pass rushers, they're elite athletes. You see the speed and the quickness, and then you teach them all the hand technique. Well, Johnson's calling card is already hand technique. He doesn't have any of the athletic stuff. So how much better can he get? So those are two big questions that I think are very reasonable for two of the three first round picks the Jets have. And then you just go into the regular, you know, variants of, yeah, we all love Sauce Gardner, but maybe he's just not going to work out. And all of a sudden you wonder if this three-person first round will even work out for the Jets. Remember, the Dolphins had one of these 2 years ago with Tua and Noah Igbinoghe, the defensive back whose name I always get wrong, and tackle Austin Jackson. And none of those guys have been very good so far.
Right.
So just because the Jets have three guys in the first round does not mean any of them are going
to
work out.
Yeah, and I know you and I have been around long enough to see a countless number of Bills coaching staffs that have been unable to make high draft choices after they get here appreciably better. I mean, you can make the argument Marcell Dareus walked in here a very talented player as the third overall pick, and he had a couple of productive seasons, but did his career arc kind of go up and up and up, or was he just kind of a leveling off guy? And there have been other guys like that that have come through here on various coaching staffs, which is why I think the biggest separator with McDermott's coaching staff from the ones that came before him is players get better after they get here, even if they're already good.
And I think the other part of that with the McDermott staff is that they've had the time to develop. How many of these guys have gotten better in year three? Devin Singletary, Dawson Knox, Deion Dawkins, you know, these other coaching staffs, the Jets are already in year two with Robert Saleh. which means if things don't immediately get better, you might have 2 years at most with Gardner and Wilson and Jermaine Johnson. And then all of a sudden you're recycling a coaching staff again. This is a good way to make sure guys don't develop when they're learning something over and over every other season. In Buffalo, that doesn't happen because it's been the same message for five consecutive years, and it very likely be the same message 5 years going forward.
Yeah. David on the tweet sheet says, the good news for the Bills is that, yes, the Jets and the Fish are improved, but both teams are a year away from being a year away. The Jets rookies are great, but they're still rookies. The Fish will need a year for the new head coach to build a culture, even with new great players. I think that's the one thing that people are forgetting about. As excited as people are about Tyreek Hill and all the other additions that the Dolphins made in free agency and, to a much lesser extent, the draft, it's also a new coach, which means a new scheme on offense for Tua. And I just think that that's going to take some time. That's why I was kind of happy to see the Bills get the Dolphins in the first month of the season. Before they really have their feet under them, you know, in the new system, the Bills are going to have an opportunity to feast on those guys before they've got all their ducks in a row. And so I think that's advantage Bills in week three on September 25th.
The one thing I think David is overlooking here, and I know, especially with a new head coach, generally it takes time to develop. It doesn't always take time. You know, I mean, Sean McVay walked into the Rams and made Jared Goff a Super Bowl caliber quarterback like that. You know, so it's not necessarily something that's going to take a long time. And, you know, from the Jets' point of view, no one was talking about the Bengals as a Super Bowl team this time last year.
Right.
Now, the Jets are not going to the Super Bowl. But, you know, you can take big jumps in this league relatively easily, and it happens every year. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and predict the Jets or the Dolphins will do that, but both teams certainly have a lot of the ingredients that go into a team that does make that jump.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. And we go to Tom in West Seneca. What do you have for us, Tom? You're on One Bills Live. Whoop, hold on. Let me pull you up again here. There we go, Tom. Now we got you. You're on One Bills Live, Tom.
No, I'm from the West Side, not West Seneca.
Oh, West Side. Okay.
Hey, Chris and Thad. To answer your question, I would say every team in the AFC improved, except for New England and Cleveland.
Hmm. Even with
Watson.
I feel
bad for Cleveland because they're in the position we used to be in where we never had a good team. And now they're in all this turmoil. So I feel bad for Cleveland.
Well, the fans you feel bad for.
Yeah, yeah. Do we think Pittsburgh got better? I'm not sure they did. I like a lot of the guys they drafted late receiver-wise, but you lose Ben Roethlisberger. I know he was nothing last year, basically, but I don't know how much better that team is this year than they were last year.
Yeah, but they did get Trubisky, and I think Trubisky is a better quarterback than he's been given the opportunity, and he got to sit behind Josh Allen last year.
Yeah.
So he could be a well-improved quarterback this year. He had a winning record when he was starting for Chicago.
It's fair.
And they let him go.
Yeah, you're right. He was 16-9 as a starter there. Good call, Tom. Thanks for it. Yeah, I mean, I hear what he's saying. But I would tend to agree with you on Pittsburgh there, Thad. I don't think they got any better. Their D-line got older with Stephon Tuitt retiring unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. So now your starting defensive end there on the front three is Cameron Hayward, who's going to turn 34 before the season's over. Tyson Alualu at 35 is your nose tackle. And you have a gaping hole where Stephon Tuitt, who was only 30 years old, decided to call it a career. And, yeah, they drafted DeMarvin Leal out of Texas A&M in like the third round, but you want that guy starting and playing meaningful snaps right away? That's really not the way Pittsburgh does it, especially with a third round draft choice. So they got some areas to fix. And oh, by the way, Minkah Fitzpatrick wants a new contract.
And look, it's been 20 years since they've had to deal with a new quarterback, you know, and I know some franchises, Green Bay, Indianapolis, they transition right to a new quarterback and it looks okay. You know, I don't know. Kenny Pickett is not Andrew Luck or Aaron Rodgers for sure. I think Pittsburgh has confidence in the machine they've built from ownership on down with Mike Tomlin as the head coach. I think they do a really good job developing skill players over and over. So, you know, if they draft a receiver in the second round, I look at that player a little better than every other team's second round receiver, but there are big questions. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about how great the AFC West is. you know, Baltimore and Cincinnati are already brutal teams, you know, and the Ravens had a really good draft. I thought about putting them in the top five most improved teams. They should be healthier this year simply because they can't be less healthy than they were last year.
Yeah.
So, you know, Pittsburgh's in a really tough division, and that's not even including Deshaun Watson possibly playing this year.
Right. And it's interesting that you're talking about the AFC North here, because Steve and I often have conversations, and he is convinced that Cincinnati was a one-off last year. While he totally says their receiving core is dynamic, it's probably one of the best and most talented in the entire league, he's not even sure they're going to make the playoffs next year, because he is expecting Baltimore to come back with a vengeance this season after what, you know, they were beset with injuries last. I mean, that was unprecedented. I actually had one of the Baltimore reporters on last week as we're kind of going through all the Bills' opponents as we get closer and closer to training camp. And I asked him, I said, did John Harbaugh actually conduct, for lack of a better term, an investigation into why they had so many injuries? I mean, you remember they had two of their starting corners go down 20 minutes apart from one another in the same practice, and both were non-contact.
Their entire running back room was gone in like a
week.
That's
right. And he said, yeah, he did like a full-scale investigation, not only in how the injuries occurred, but like their practice schedule. Did all the injuries happen on like a Friday or a Thursday in the practice week? Like, are there any, they were looking for patterns, anything. They were slicing and dicing it up 18 different ways to see if they could find a root cause for some of the injuries, especially some of the catastrophic season ending injuries, of which I think the guy told me 65 or 70% of the injuries on the Ravens roster were either 8 week or more, or season, they were at least 8 weeks or season ending injuries. 65%.
That's bananas. And that's not 65% of four, you know, it's 65% of like 20.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were, now I don't know if I'm with Steve in calling Cincinnati a one-off. I will say that I think the historical trend is the team that loses the Super Bowl misses the playoffs the next year a lot. But Cincinnati did a really good job in the offseason too. I mean, offensive line was their big issue, and they addressed it, you know, multiple times. So somebody's got to miss the playoffs in the AFC. I mean, there's way more than seven good teams in the AFC. Someone's not going, you know, and I would put money on Miami making the playoffs right now, just because they get to play out of the AFC East and probably have easier games against the Patriots and Jets than what the West and the North teams are playing. So if Miami's going, you know, either two of Denver or the Chargers or the Bengals or the Ravens are not going. And you know, these teams are not non-playoff teams, but again, someone's got to miss.
Right. Which, you know, and everybody says with the AFC West as good as they are, does that mean they could get three teams in? I think that's going to be really tough, but I wouldn't be bowled over if it happened. I think you could make an argument. Like for the Chargers and the, I mean, you can make an argument for any team in that division. I think the Raiders are probably the biggest long shot of the bunch, but that's not a bad team. And they eked out the Chargers last year. So I could see a way where three AFC West teams get in. I wouldn't bet on it, but at the same time, it wouldn't stun me if it happened.
No, I'm thinking two out of the West, two out of the North. And I think either the Colts Titans loser or whichever AFC East team's young quarterback develops the fastest will be the other wild card. I don't think it's going to be three from the West, because there's too much damage that division's going to do against each other. You know, and even though they play the South and get some breaks there, you know, I think the third place team in the West is going to be a really, really good 9-8 team that misses the playoffs.
Dang. You're going to be 9-8 after all of that work you did in the offseason to make your roster.
It's going to happen to somebody.
Well, I know.
No way all four of those teams win 10 games, you know? And I think it'd be pretty reasonable to think two of them don't.
Yeah. It's crazy to think like all the investments these teams made and all they're going to have to show for it is a 9-8 season and no playoffs again.
Yeah.
Yeesh. All right. We got to take a break here. When we come back, I am going to run by Thad some of ESPN's Mike Clay's 2022 Bills individual player projections. I'm going to throw some numbers at you as to what he expects from these guys. You tell me what you think, Thad. And then we might have some time for for a little NFL true false. All that coming up next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, so we've talked for a while about most improved teams in the league. Wanted to get some Bills stuff in here as well. Mike Clay from ESPN, who's done this for a long time, big on number crunching, building projection models for each of the 32 NFL teams. He has done that, and I am holding in my hand the Bills' 2022 projections, courtesy of Mike Clay from ESPN.com. So I'm going to run some of these individual player numbers at you, Thad. You tell me what you think, if you think he's relatively on the mark with these projections. And a lot of these are historically number-based on his part. So we'll start with the obvious one, Josh Allen. He's got him completing 64.1% of his passes, throwing for 4,119 yards, 33 passing touchdowns, 13 picks, 7 rushing touchdowns, 681 yards on the ground for Josh Allen. What do we think of those? I'll take them.
Oh, the numbers are great. I mean, there's no team in the league that wouldn't sign up for that from their quarterback. I think he's got the completion percentage right, ticking up a little bit from 63.3% last year. I think that there's going to be more of the I don't want to say dump-offs, but the shorter, you know, let guys run. There's a little better group this year of yards after the catch guy receivers, James Cook particularly. So I like that. Down from 4,400 yards, I think that's a little curious. I think Josh is going to be up yard-wise. I'd go probably about 4,600. Touchdowns and interceptions I like, because, again, I think safer – higher percentage completion percentage more likely than last year. 36 and 15 was the TD to interception ratio last year. Rush wise, I think the Bills want Josh Allen to run less. I know he's an incredible weapon there, but I think the idea of exposing him to all this punishment over and over is something this team does not want to do as much as it has to. Last year ran for about 760 yards. I think that number goes down below 600 next year. And I think they try and, you know, take some of the wear and tear off Josh Allen's body.
Yeah, 681 seemed like a fat number to me for a rushing total.
Yes.
For this coming year. I think he's still going to be a rushing threat in the red zone, but between the 20s, yeah, I agree with you. I think he's going to do a whole lot less than that. I would prefer to see the number somewhere around 500, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I would like it down there.
30 yards a game, that'd be perfect.
Yeah. Yep. Receivers, Stephon Diggs, he has with 97 receptions, 1,198 yards, 9 touchdowns. And as you'll see with some of these other projections I give you in a second, Thad, I think he's got Diggs just under 1,200 because he has the wealth being spread out a little bit more. What do you think about that?
I'm surprised at that. You know, there's 124 catches between Emmanuel Sanders and Cole Beasley that you think would have to be divvied up. Now, you know, from the Josh Allen projections, Mike Clay thinks the passing will be a little less. That's fine. So 115, whatever. I think Stephon Diggs is going to be the recipient of some of them because he is the most trusted, the most veteran receiver on this team. I know Jameson Crowder has been around the league for a long time, but his first year in Buffalo. So to me, you know, especially first half of next year, when Josh Allen needs to make a throw, I think Stephon Diggs is the most likely guy to get it. So I think Diggs' number is going to go up. I'd project him 110 catches, 14. I think he's going to have a monster year because the rest of the receiving core is generally young and or inexperienced in Buffalo guys. I think I agree with Mike Clay, and I'm sure you're going to get into this with the rest of the numbers. I think that the wealth beyond Diggs will be more spread than it's been because Cole Beasley's had big numbers as the number two receiver the last couple of years. I don't think we'll see quite that kind of production out of Gabriel Davis, whoever the number two is this year.
Yeah, I mean, he's got Davis 63 for 918 and 9 touchdowns. I think he's on the money with the 9 touchdowns because Gabriel Davis had 6 last year, 7 the year before, and he only had 35 receptions in each of those years. You double his receptions, I think he gets pretty close to 10 touchdowns.
I would disagree there. I think the reason Gabriel Davis's touchdown number is up, he, for whatever reason, is the guy that's always on the back end of the trick play. There's at least a half dozen over the last 2 years, you know, either highly deceptive plays or flat out, you know, Cole Beasley making the throw plays where Gabriel Davis is just catching a wide open ball. And I think the reason for that is he is the best blocking receiver, is the guy the Bills suspect would be the most likely person to be ignored, you know, in a passing situation. That won't be the case next year. He's the number two receiver. This is a guy that's not going to be ignored. So if I had to bet, I think he's under 6 touchdowns that he had last year.
Wow.
I don't think he even gets back to that number because of the fact he's not going to be that guy anymore. Now, it doesn't say anything bad about – I don't think touchdown is an indication of how good or bad a receiver you are. I just think Davis not being the trick play catch guy, you know, making him have to earn the touchdowns the normal way, drops that number next year.
Okay. So we'll respectfully disagree on that. I think Davis is the real.
I know I'm on an island there, Chris. That's fine.
Yeah, I think Davis is the real deal. I think he'll still win on routes, even with more attention. I think he can get to 9 touchdowns, especially with the extra time on the field. Jamison Crowder, here's the one that I was most interested in seeing. And he's got him at 59 receptions for 611 yards and 5 TDs.
Sounds about right. I'm very curious to see what this Bills offense is going to look like. The last 2 years, it's been the more traditional. We're going to have 2 outside receivers and a slot guy, and we're just going to, you know, pass you into oblivion. It feels like this year, with the Bills drafting a running back who can catch in James Cook, drafting a receiver who can run in Khalil Shakur, going with a tight end that can, you know, an O.J. Howard as your number 2 tight end, a guy who can, you know, present a run look but still be a threat in the pass, it doesn't feel like the Bills are going to go to a traditional, yes, we're going to pass and you can't beat it, here it comes kind of look. They're going to try and be multiple, present different looks. Jamison Crowder is not a guy that fits in that part of the offense. He's your absolutely 100% typical slot receiver, really good at it. But I don't know how much the Bills come out in that offensive look this year where they want to use a receiver who's, yeah, when he's on the field, they're going to throw type guy. So I really think that Jamison Crowder's numbers are going to be lower than expected. I like Cook's receiving numbers to be higher. I like O.J. Howard maybe to be a little higher than expected. And like I said, I think the wealth is going to be a lot more spread out among your non-typical receiving options than it has been in Buffalo the last couple of years.
So are you including McKenzie in that equation? Because he's got him for just 25 catches for 242 yards and a pair of touchdowns.
I think McKenzie's a factor. I think those numbers are probably pretty accurate. I don't think McKenzie's a guy that's taken away touches from Crowder. I think having Howard on the field, having Cook on the field, having Shakir on the field, I think those guys take snaps away from Crowder, and that, to me, would depress his outlook from my point of view. I've been telling people who've been asking me fantasy-wise what to do with Jamison Crowder, I would avoid him because people are going to look at him as the slot receiver in this great offense as a, you know, dependable third fantasy guy, and I don't think he's going to be that. I could easily be wrong, but that's my take on it so far.
Yeah, and because of that, you're going to be disappointed in O.J. Howard's projections here by Mike Clay. He's got him.
Yeah, give me what has he got?
He's got him for 12 receptions for 140 yards and a touchdown. He's got Knox's numbers down too, from what they were last year. He's got him at 46 for 557 and 6 touchdowns. Last year, Knox was 49, 587 and 9 touchdowns.
How about this? I say O.J. Howard has 12 catches before October.
Okay. Okay.
I think now I might be a little, I'll say, let me amend that. He'll have 12 catches by Halloween. I think Howard's going to be a very viable part of this offense, a guy that will be used, they're going to try and use him because there's no reason not to have him on the field if you're not going to use him as part of the passing game. I think Knox's numbers go up a tick from 49 and about 600 yards last year. I got him about 55 and maybe 700, I think, next year. I think tight ends in the passing game is something this Bills team really wants to do.
Right, and I don't know if it's going to feature both of those guys every single week. I think it's going to be largely opponent-based, but in the red zone, I think you'd almost be foolish to not have both of those guys on the field. They're your two biggest targets in the whole arsenal at 6'5+. I mean, they put their arms over their head and, you know, they're 9.5 feet tall. Just throw it up to them and they're going to outjump whoever they have at DB, even a 6'3 corner like Sauce Gardner. They're taller than that guy. So have at it. I could see their touchdown production being very high. I'm still not sold on the catches and the yardage, though. That's the only place where I'm having trouble with that.
I'm down on Knox touchdowns, by the way. I think the term touchdown regression is something you're going to hear used
in
Knox a lot.
It's hard to duplicate 9 touchdowns at the tight end position unless you're Travis Kelce. Okay, so flipping it over to defense, let's just quickly run through maybe some of the guys people are most interested in. Von Miller, they have at 10.5 sacks. Ed Oliver, a little over 4.5 sacks. Greg Rousseau, 4.8 sacks.
Those numbers sound good. I think Von Miller would be a little above. I think he's going to get a lot of opportunity to obviously, you know, play and have an impact. You know, I think Greg Rousseau, to be a real factor this year, is going to have to, you know, show something early. And I don't know how much – I don't want to say he's going to have a short leash, but, you know, I think Von Miller is going to be the guy they rely on. And I know he's going to get all the attention, but he's just that good. So I would say over 10.5 sacks for Von Miller. I think over Fred Oliver, too. I think he's going to continue to get better. Not a lot over, but a little over. And I'd probably go under for Greg Rousseau. I'm not a huge Rousseau fan right now. I'm hoping, you know, from the Bills' point of view, that Miller can, you know, impart some of the knowledge that he's gained over the years, not only just on himself, but, you know, as part of that pass rush summit that he's been doing the last few years, which is fantastic.
Yep.
But I would go under Rousseau 4.8.
And then last, projected wins. He's got the Bills at 11.9, which is the highest win total of any team that he has in the NFL. 11.9. So obviously that means he feels 12 wins is good enough for the number one seed in the AFC. What do you think?
I think it'll take more than that. I know we've talked about teams beating each other up, how hard these other divisions are. I would be surprised if no one in the AFC gets the 13 wins. So I would think that's the number you're shooting for the number one seed. That said, and last year at this time, the Bills over under in Vegas was 11. And the Bills last year at this time had the most money on the over of any team in the NFL. And last year, over 11 looked like a lock. And then it pushed. So, you know, I think the idea that the Bills are a guaranteed 12 to 13 win team, probably not accurate. A lot of things can happen in the NFL. But I would bet the over, and I would say 13-4 is your number one seed record out of the AFC this year.
Quickly, the games with the least odds of the Bills winning, win probability the lowest. Week 1 against the Rams, 51% chance to win. Week 6 against the Chiefs, 51% chance to win. Week 17 at Cincinnati, 48% chance to win the football game. Everything after that is 59% or better. We have to take a break here. When we come back, we'll get a couple more stories from Thad on the golf outing yesterday. That's next here on One Bills Live. Stay tuned. All right, Thad, time is short, so hit us with your best golf stories from the Bills media golf event yesterday.
I'll give you the one big one. So AJ Feldman, who works with me, got to play in the tournament for the first time, and he was hired during COVID, so had not played in a previous tournament. So I purposely did not tell Bill's PR that he's a great golfer. 6 handicap, bombs it off the tee, hoping that he'd end up in my group. No such luck. He played with Nate Geary from WGR, is very good, and Matt Barkley. And I figured backup quarterback, probably good player.
Right.
Sure enough, I walk over to the range. Matt Barkley's warming up. First drive is like into the stratosphere, and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, no one else is winning today. And sure enough, on like the fifth hole, we were in the group in front of the AJ Feldman, Matt Barkley group, 340 par 4. We're getting off the green, kind of, you know, getting to the cart. All of a sudden we hear something. AJ had dumped his drive in the greenside bunker, and then Barkley hit his about 10 yards past that, like pin high. The tee shot at a par 4.
Safe.
So they won the tournament. And I just want to point out to everybody, we had a lot of players there. They were intensely competitive. So after the round, Bill's PR, a lot of people are coming up to me like, why didn't you tell us how good AJ was? What the heck, man? AJ said he goes to the bathroom and passes Jordan Phillips, who's a really good golfer, finished second, 8-under to AJ's 11-under. Jordan Phillips goes to AJ. He's like, hey, are you AJ? AJ says, yeah. And Phillips goes, bleep you. And then just walks to the bathroom. So, I mean, they took it absolutely serious.
Wow.
We loved it. It was a good thing.
I can't imagine Jordan Phillips off the tee. It's a lot of motion putting into a golf ball.
He's really good from what I understand. I didn't see him swing much, but a really good player.
All right. Thanks for your help with the show today, Thad. We'll catch up with you soon. Enjoy your summer. We'll see you tomorrow here at 1:00.